Summer, the best time of year, usually doesn't come with a great deal. Soaring temperatures come with soaring prices. But what if there's another way? With IKEA, your summer plans can last longer than 2 weeks of vacation and be more affordable. Here, everyone can have lounge chair access, no reservations needed. From affordable outdoor furniture to stylish accessories, we have all the essentials you need to soak up summer in style, no matter the size of your space. Start planning a better summer with IKEA. It's your outdoor dreams inside your budget.
I'm Ezra Klein. This is The Ezra Klein Show. One question I've been thinking about during this series on the rising right is whether the balance of power in the Republican Party is shifting. For years, social conservatives provided the GOP its votes and its shock troops, but the economic conservatives got all the policy. Republicans would win by mobilizing evangelicals and then use that power to pass corporate tax cuts. But it feels like we may be at an inflection point. The multi-decade effort to stack the Supreme Court with hardcore social conservatives is paying off. Roe looks like it's going to be overturned. And beyond that, if you look at the new generation of right-wing politicians like Josh Hawley and Ron DeSantis and J.D. Vance, you see that economic policy is really up for debate. This is a different party than the Paul Ryan Republican Party. But it's social policy where the clear lines are being drawn. There's a very widespread view among this cohort and the thinkers are drawing on that Republican politicians of recent years put markets first and families and churches and communities last. And the result has been social disintegration and cultural chaos. But I think it's fair to say the critique is far ahead of the policy agenda right now. I think you saw this a bit in the Patrick Deneen episode from a few weeks back. You get this very strident populism that sometimes seems to resolve down into almost generic center-left policy ideas. You get these slashing social critiques that end in a shrug about what is to be done. But that's not going to be good enough for long. If Roe is indeed overturned, the Republican Party in general and social conservatives in particular are going to be the dogs that caught the car. Most Americans don't want abortion banned. And the right will need some answer for them, some way to show that they are pro-family, even pro-women, not just anti-abortion. That they have an answer to the struggles families face that goes beyond removing reproductive choice and attacking liberals. One place they might look for that more holistic vision is in the work of Erica Bakiaki. Bakiaki is a legal scholar at the Conservative Ethics and Public Policy Center and the director of the Wollstonecraft Project at the Abigail Adams Institute. And in her 2021 book, The Rights of Women, Reclaiming a Lost Vision, she tries to build a structure, a philosophical structure, going back to older thinkers, for a socially conservative feminism, one that embraces women's gains in professional and civic life, but holds that abortion and technological forms of contraception and the sexual revolution were devastating for women's well-being and the cultivation of virtue and duty. She connects this to this broader critique that Republicans for too long have put markets first and families last. Her view is that abortion and contraception, and you'll hear this, really serve the needs of capital at the expense of families. And with Roe gone, Bakiaki believes that a truly pro-family conservatism and even country can flourish. And so I wanted to have her on to draw out the story she's telling and that conservatives are increasingly trying to tell and try to understand whether it holds up and what kind of agenda it drives. As always, my email, EzraKleinShow@nytimes.com. Erica Bakiaki, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ezra.
So you say that the gender revolution has, quote, stalled. Tell me why.
Ooh, that's a big question. In The Rights of Women, I tell the story of the cause of women's rights through kind of the lens of sexual and reproductive asymmetry. I think for a long time in the 1980s, and then still you hear this in different circles that, you know, the real question of feminism is, you know, are women and men the same or are women and men different? And I don't really think that's that difficult of a question. I think there's many ways in which we're the same and many ways in which we're different. And we can talk certainly about what those are. But it seems to me that the question of sexual and reproductive asymmetry The fact that men and women engage in the same sexual act in heterosexual sex, but that women can get pregnant and men cannot, is really the one that all feminists are responding to in their different kind of ways. And so I think we've seen women advance in so many ways, except there isn't this concomitant valuing of the work that's done by women in pregnancy, and then the work that's done by both men and women in the home. And so we tend to, I think, see the modern day women's movement really capitulate to kind of a market logic where equality is seen kind of in market terms, a market equality where instead of this, you know, women as caregivers and men as breadwinners, both men and women are kind of valued only as breadwinners. And that really important work of care that women especially, but increasingly, you know, generationally speaking, men too really value that work of care they do in the home has not been valued in the market and by our public institutions. And that has been especially, I think, difficult for poor women.
So I'm in very deep agreement that a profound problem in our society is that we don't value care work. And in the book, you're drawing a fairly deep connection between the rise of contraception, abortion rights, and Roe particularly, the change in our sexual culture, the rise of single parenthood, to that devaluing or lack of valuing of care work. And that's where I want to try to understand the causal chain a bit better. You're making a causal claim that contraception and abortion create this dominance of market logic, this devaluing of the family. And I think you're making this claim, lead women to be worse off. And so first, is that a fair read of the argument that you think this has made women worse off?
Well, I think you could say that in some ways, if you were just counting sort of economic measures, you would say that elite women are better off, right? So their elite women use contraception quite effectively. They still tend to have children within marriage, which tends to be much better for them in terms of their own balance between caregiving and work outside the home. And I think there's ways in which it hasn't been good for elite women. The other part that's, I think, real male normative is the way in which the casual sex culture has become sort of the default. And I think that's tends to be better for sort of a male sexuality. Now, it's not to say that there aren't kind of alpha women who like sex on the first date or the first meeting, but all sorts of data shows us that women tend to prefer sex and actually enjoy sex much more in commitment. So in that way, elite women aren't better off. I think all in all, poor women are worse off. The abortion-backed contraceptive revolution has allowed men especially to basically, you know, gives them more reason to walk away from unexpected pregnancy. And so when poor women choose to have their children, which they tend to do in larger numbers when those children are unexpected than wealthy women do and educated women do, they're bereft of the paternal support they need, both emotional support for their own children, for themselves in the difficult work of caregiving, but also especially financial support. And I think that's led to, you know, a feminization of poverty. This isn't just me saying it, but a lot of sort of what I call sexual economics, you know, George Akerlof, Janet Yellen's work, and others who have really pointed to the way in which the pill has really been an instigator in this technological shock that has created more single motherhood. And what do we see but single motherhood is the single greatest predictor of poverty in our country. And it's not just financial poverty, but a real difficulty, the kind of stress that single mothers have on them in raising children without paternal support, without men in the lives. And we can point to all sorts of ways in which our current economy and economic transitions have harmed men and made them incapable of being there. And that's certainly a tangled web, greater, you know, incarceration rates and all sorts of things like that. And I think a pretty good argument can be made, at least I try to make it, that disconnecting and decoupling sex from marriage and marriage from childbearing is pretty devastating for the poor.
So I want to put a pin in the question of poverty, because we're definitely going to come back to that. But let's take this at the sort of different sequential layers of the question. And so let's begin with the changes you identify in America's, and probably, you know, broadly Western, even global sexual culture, driven certainly in part by technologies like the pill. And let me ask the question this way. What for you is the role of pleasure in thinking about when sex is ethical and virtuous and desirable?
Yeah, no, I think that that's an important question in the sense that it seems to me that the way sex as thought about today is very much self-expression, is very much pleasure in mind. And I think, again, there are pretty dangerous asymmetries for women there, because when you decouple sex from marriage and from childbearing, and pleasure is left to be the only sort of marker, that it tends to be far better for men. And let me lay that out a bit more. I mean, I think pleasure is a great side effect, we could say, to sex. I think it's great when sex is pleasurable. But as it turns out, for women, sex is far more pleasurable in commitment. And why in commitment? Because for sex to be pleasurable for women, there needs to be kind of a vulnerability where a woman is relaxed enough to enjoy sex and her partner needs to really take interest in her sexual pleasure. And that doesn't generally come in the hookup culture. Christine Emba's new book, I think it's called Rethinking Sex, A Provocation. She, I think, in there has some data about the real orgasm gap that you see in the casual sex culture today. So I think that is in itself a real marker of kind of the decline of good sex, both in the sense of like pleasurable sex, but also, you know, what she calls good or ethical sex, which I, you know, think that there's more sex within marriage. And I think women enjoy sex better in marriage when they can be more vulnerable. So I guess in that way, freeing women to have sex just like men, which is basically what the pill and abortion do, I think also hasn't been good for women. You know, it sounds like I'm just blaming men, but men have, you know, blasts of testosterone beating through them in a way that's different from, it's distinguished from women. And that does tend to lend to, you know, greater sort of sexual desire and sexual aggression, especially sex that is quicker and easier, you know, quicker release. It's a different kind of sex than women want. And so to really engage in the kind of sex that women want, that is slower, that is in commitment, that is attentive to a woman's sexual needs and desires, I think really requires, if there's going to be an equalizing, that men sort of change their responses to their sexual appetites to be more attentive to what women need rather than vice versa, which is what I think we've done.
There's definitely a part of me that is having a not all men moment right here, but putting male defensiveness aside.
And I agree. I agree.
This is, I think, a key sort of interlock here. So even if I grant the claim, even if you grant the claim that sex is better within committed partnership, which I think is probably broadly true, what I understand you as arguing is that the wide use of contraception, certainly what you call technopharmacological contraception, is somewhere in between a problem and at least something worth rethinking. That Roe should be overturned, which is, I think, where we're going. Abortion should be either illegal or extremely, extremely hard to access. And that seems like a pretty different claim, actually, than it would be good if there was more committed relationships and people had more confidence and capability to relax into the pleasures of sex and the connection of sex within these contexts. And so it sometimes seems to me that the argument being made here isn't just that there would be more pleasure in this world, but actually we need a lot more potential punishment. There needs to be a lot more fear disciplining sex, fear of getting pregnant, fear of having a child that you're not ready to have, or maybe is not safe for you to have. And so people have, you know, even if they're not all happy with, you know, what got called hookup culture a couple of years ago, people have sort of widely embraced these solutions as helping them live lives that, you know, they hope to be able to make a better existence for themselves within. So what about our sexual culture would be improved by dramatically less technopharmacological contraception and, you know, no or very limited access to abortion? Can you draw that link in your argument for me?
Yeah. So I think that we've seen that there's a connection, and this is what, again, you see in the sort of sexual economic work, that the pill kind of inspires this change in sexual behavior so that there's more sexual risk taking both inside and outside of marriage. And so this, of course, is what gets you to the link I was talking about there toward single motherhood. But so What's interesting is to go back to how the early American women's rights advocates thought about this, because I think many people now know that they were opposed to abortion, and we can kind of talk about how they thought in a very nuanced way, but they really were worried about these threats of undisciplined male sexual desire. And they saw that you can make men and women equal in a lot of different ways. And as I've talked about, you can sort of bring, I think, women down to men's standards, which is, you know, kind of freewheeling, quick sex, or you can bring men up to women's standards, which is actually what these women were hoping for, that they could convince men that voluntary motherhood, this idea, I mean, sounds a lot like our, you know, desire not to have forced motherhood, which is a real, you know, kind of pro-choice slogan. But what it is their belief, their understanding that women were mothers as soon as they got pregnant, and that they should voluntarily enter into that state because of the asymmetrical burdens for them. And therefore, they should voluntarily, you know, have sex, which means they could have the right to say no to sex within marriage. But what they wanted in response was not actually abortion or contraception. What they wanted was this sense that there should be abstinence during the fertile period. Now, at that time, there was no good medical science that helped them to understand when the fertile period was. And so there were all sorts of unintended pregnancies, which obviously made the whole situation worse in some ways. But there's been a lot of advance in our day. And I think if we hadn't been relying on, you know, abortion and contraception, that we'd see even more advance in the way in which natural fertility regulation has come around. You know, you see all sorts of young women, actually, I hear they're on TikTok, you know, being angry about contraception and really being interested, more interested in natural fertility regulation. I haven't seen them myself. Friends tell me that. But I think there is a move, because kind of an ecological case against hormonal birth control, that, you know, throwing a lot of hormones into the waterways hasn't been great for aquatic life. But I think the same could be said for ourselves. You know, we want organic food. We want to, you know, take care of our bodies in all sorts of ways. And yet here we are consuming, you know, vast quantities of hormones to regulate our cycles. And so because of the harms of the casual sex culture to women, because they're not interested in it, you're seeing the way in which perhaps these natural fertility regulation may be better. And there's a way in which, too, because it demands abstinence of men during certain times, that it is getting them to be more aware in their bodies, just as women are every month because of menses, of really the connection between sex and potential parenthood. And I think that's a good thing.
So for people who maybe aren't familiar, can you say more about what you mean by natural fertility regulation? What does that actually entail for people on a practical level?
Yes. So though I'm no expert on natural fertility regulation, it's an area of kind of medicine that has really grown and changed a lot over the last several decades. And now there's all sorts of apps and, you know, things for your phone and all of that. But generally what it is it's getting an understanding, a much deeper, better understanding of women's fertility. So there are all sorts of signs of fertility that a woman's body, I guess you could say, emits, things like cervical fluid, rises and falls in temperature, that indicate to the woman how fertile she is and when she could get pregnant.
Summer, the best time of year, usually doesn't come with a great deal. Soaring temperatures come with soaring prices. But what if there's another way? With IKEA, your summer plans can last longer than 2 weeks of vacation and be more affordable. Here, everyone can have lounge chair access, no reservations needed. From affordable outdoor furniture to stylish accessories, we have all the essentials you need to soak up summer in style, no matter the size of your space. Start planning a better summer with IKEA. It's your outdoor dreams inside your budget.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
So the argument here, and I notice this in the book too, it feels to me that it operates at two levels that are a little bit different or worth interrogating. So one is this level of, we could call it the ideal, or what culture should understand as virtuous. And I might have different views on this, but let's grant yours here. So if things go right, is a way to put this, right? If the rhythm method or other forms of natural contraception are very, very well followed, if abstinence is very well followed, if within committed relationships there aren't things like coercion or abuse or just pressure, right? There's just a lot of pressure in relationships. There's fear of people being left. And so one version is we should have the sexual ideal that is more restrained, more disciplined, more held back than what we currently have. But law, and a lot of this book is about law, and a lot of your advocacy is about law. Law is very much about what happens when things go wrong, when you have sex and maybe you wish you hadn't, or the form of contraception you were using fails. I mean, my understanding of the data is that about a quarter of people who try natural contraception of the kind you're describing will get pregnant in the first year. Now, if you do it perfectly, that number's lower, but it's very, very, very hard to do perfectly. And maybe people could get better, but people are people. And so the question I think then becomes, what should happen when things fail? And as I understand your argument, what should happen when things fail, when you or your partner want to have sex in a relationship or even non-relationship where you're not ready for children, or you're in a relationship where you already have children and you didn't want more and you're using the rhythm method but actually got pregnant anyway, is that it would be better. It would be better for women. It would be better for families. It would be better for society if at that point you had fewer options. Like, you could not end a pregnancy. I really can't quite tell what your view is on technical, more technological contraception, but I at least think you're philosophically against. So I think the question is, knowing humans as we do, that's not going to work out for a lot of people. And what happens to them? Why would it be better for them to be in this world where a moment of impulsivity or misregulating your cycle or feeling pressured by your husband results in a pregnancy that you really didn't want and now cannot end?
Yeah, so I do want to get to the question of abortion, which I think is obviously a very important one. I just want to correct you, though, on this idea of the, quote, rhythm method, which is really, really an old, old understanding of this. I mean, it's like half century old or something. And that actually the best methods rival the birth control pill are 1%. I mean, the birth control pill also requires a certain discipline, right, that you take it every day. And so, you know, there are method failure and user failure rates for both, but it's a question of which one is better, I think, for the woman especially, but for the couple. And I think, you know, again, I would not advocate all of the different methods of natural fertility regulation. I think some are not as good, but there are some that are excellent. And I actually, you know, have end notes on this where you can kind of find some of the differences. The interesting thing about this, I mean, I am under no illusion that, you know, you can sort of put the toothpaste back in the tube and, you know, everyone will stop using contraception. I'm very much aware that there are many people for whom contraception, whatever their form of contraception, they're happy with it. It's given them a lot of options in their life and all that. And one thing that I think is really interesting is how easy access to abortion as we've had, at least prior to, say, the last 10, 15 years, when obviously red states have been able to regulate a lot more and pushed a lot of, you know, abortion clinics out of states, but generally easy access to abortion actually tends to disincentivize contraceptive use. So there's a way in which, because it's there as a backstop, it changes the behavior of those who are engaging in sex, both engaging in sexual risk-taking in terms of having more of it and changing their decision-making around whether they should have sex or not, but also with regard to how careful they are about their contraception. So I would say that if you're really pro-contraception, and even if you think, you know, natural fertility regulation is, you know, a crock or whatever, and if you really want to see more people using contraception as a way to, say, lower the abortion rate, then actually restricting abortion more would tend to do that. So my view of that is good, then restrict abortion more, because then people will take the sexual act more seriously and be more responsible with their sexual activity. And then, of course, we come to the question of abortion, which is a huge a huge matter in itself. But it seems to me that going back to how the early women's rights advocates thought about it is also really helpful. I think there's a lot of wisdom there in the sense that they believed, based on advances in embryology at the time, which is also what was informing the doctors who were lobbying for enhanced restrictions of abortion, those early women's rights advocates, so like Victoria Woodhill, who is a real radical, definitely not a Christian, others too, like her, not Christians, but understood, you know, as she said, that the rights of the child should begin while they're a fetus, who saw that mothers had this responsibility for embryonic life. That's how she talked about it. And so what they wanted to do was improve conditions so much for women, so improve maternal and fetal health. They opened female-led hospitals for women, maternity homes for women, so that women who were abandoned by men would have be given kind of the skills and the confidence to care for their children. And also, of course, entry into the professions, all of these things, so that women would not feel this kind of desperate need to abort. I think it's really good to go back and sort of understand how is it that they saw abortion as both an act of violence against the unborn child, but also a way in which it kind of opened the floodgates to this, you know, presumptive male sexuality. And just to ask, is there a way in which if we limited abortion more, we could kind of realign things and start to work really for the justice of both the children to whom I think care is due, but then also to women and men, you know, who are caregivers to whom we owe a lot more duties because of the work they do in the home than society right now is willing to afford them.
Well, I do think this actually gets to the nut of it, because I want to keep what the goals of different people in this conversation are very clear. So in the abortion conversation we just had, you made an argument there that if we didn't have abortion, people would use contraception more effectively, more nearly universally. I don't really agree with that. I think there's actually quite good evidence out of places like Delaware. There are very good programs that have been put forward where contraception use actually does get abortion rates down. But even if I grant the argument here, I think it's important to ask the question of what is the end? I think the reason a lot of people want there to be rights to all kinds of contraception, right, including IUDs and things that I do disagree with you on the evidence here, I think are much more effective than natural methods and much easier to follow. But in addition to that, that if these things fail, or if somebody fails to use them, or if somebody is in a somewhat coerced situation, emotionally or otherwise, where they're not easy to use, or if they end up in a situation that could be harmful for their health, they have the ability to continue charting their own life's course. That's why you end up at something like the equilibrium that many liberals have now. And your argument is that equilibrium is wrong, that a mistake has been made. And I think you got to it at the end there, that having the ability to have abortion has been bad for women, bad for family policy, bad for the movement. And so I do want to try to draw out that argument. And let me ask it this way. So there's a recent New York Times analysis of data on the typical abortion patient, and it found that they have children, they're poor, they're unmarried, they're in their late 20s, they have some college education, and they're very early in pregnancy. That's the sort of modal person who gets an abortion. So if that wasn't there, how would those women be better off? What is the argument for their welfare that you're making?
So before I get back to that, I just want to clarify my position on contraception. So I do not disagree with you that contraception lowers abortion rates. I think that that's true. But I also think that restrictions on abortion get people to use contraception more. So I think that there's this causal line that goes both ways. And we've relied, I think, on free and easy abortion access which then disincentivizes contraceptive use. But I think if you actually have restrictions on abortion, then you're going to see more contraception, and therefore kind of then ends up having fewer abortions anyway. So that I think that all works okay together.
Right. But I think that the reason I'm pushing on that little point is that I don't think more contraceptive use is your goal. And I also don't think it's the goal of the people on the other side of the argument, which is why that particular argument strikes me as weird.
I mean, in some ways, I don't know that women today, with sort of the state of how women think in terms of that they sort of owe men sex at, you know, having a beer, a cup of coffee or something, that the cost of sex is so low right now that I'm not sure that I can convince women that it would be so much better for them, for their relationships, for their enjoyment of sex, to go out and learn natural fertility regulation. I am not Pollyanna on that. I would prefer more contraception use to more abortion, if that makes sense. Even though I think that natural fertility regulation is better for women than contraception, I don't think it has to be kind of a black and white thing, right? An IUD, for instance, you know, there's a lot of push for women to have IUDs, and I see it from one perspective. I mean, I think Isabel Sahil in Unbound Generation probably makes the very strongest argument for IUDs there, where she talks about, you know, that, you know, you don't want to sort of make a longstanding choice that really changes your whole life when you're sort of in the heat of the moment, when it's, you know, there to put on a condom or something. And so an IUD kind of, as she says, changes the default to infertile rather than fertile. And that, to me, I can get how that would lower both abortion rates and out of wedlock childbearing and all of that. And I see those all as a goal. But I also think that IUDs, again, increase the sexual risk-taking or the sexual, the casual sex culture, to think that it's really sort of normative to engage in casual sex. And I think, again, this has been bad for women, for their emotions, for all sorts of things, right? So in that way, I think if you're defaulting to infertile, you're also defaulting to kind of the yes, right? So in this casual sex culture, you're defaulting to, sure, yeah, we're going to have sex, versus the default being a no, and that there has to be all sorts of affirmations by a woman to engage in sex.
I think I would have probably some dispute over how defaulted things are to yes. I mean, I think it's not as lightly held as people say. And the actual data is that teenagers and young adults are having less sex, not much, much more. I in many ways think the hookup panic of a couple of years ago didn't really pan out. And in some ways, people are being much more restrained, to the point that many see that as a social problem. But nevertheless, we're still dealing with the reality that whatever methods people choose, whatever is really going on, many people, and I think even more under some of the situations that you're more interested in, will become pregnant in a situation where they really don't want to be. And so I noted that the modal person who seeks an abortion, according to this New York Times analysis, they have children, they're poor, they're unmarried, they're in their late 20s, they have some college, they're very early in pregnancy. I think you're making an argument throughout that they would be better off, not just that the unborn child would be better off, but they would be better off if they did not have the ability to get an abortion. And I'm asking from that perspective, how? Why?
Yes. So there's certainly women, as you say, in the situation where, you know, have abortions, early term abortions in very difficult situations. Most have children and are poor. And I think, one, if you look at even, you know, the way women think about, and different sort of classes of people think about abortion, those who are poor actually tend to have more moral reservations of abortion. So you then see women, I think, because of sort of economic coercion, because they don't have the financial capacity to have another child, that they're economically coerced into engaging in an act, the act of abortion, which goes up against their moral values, which is deeply concerning to me. But it takes the attention off the real structural problems in the lives of the poor, whether it's substandard health conditions, whether it's poor housing, whether it's neglectful or absent fathers, or the fact that their fathers can't get work and so can't pay child support. All of these things, I think it takes attention off that when we have abortion as kind of an easy solution, and in some way, the privileged solution to poverty? Because it's always this kind of thing. It's like, it kind of concerns me when we say, come on, shouldn't that be the answer to this poor woman's problem is for her to have an abortion? And it's like, well, I don't know that that's A, what she would really want. And I think that you see that actually in a lot of the lives of poor women, that they would choose not to have an abortion if they thought that they could afford to have a child. And so that is of great concern to me, is that we're putting poor women in a situation where the best we can get, you know, the richest country in the history of the world, is to offer them, you know, the means to have abortions.
I think this is where you can see the pathways branching out. And I think this is in many ways like the core of it. Because I think I agree with you to a large extent there. And I think most people on the left and most people who are pro-choice would, which is people should not have to make a decision they don't want to make because of poverty. They should not have to make a decision they don't want to make because the supports are not there for the family they want to have. I always want people to have the range of choices that they want for their own life flourishing open to them. The argument you're making actually quite explicitly in the book is that the way to get there is to close off the choice for abortion. Not to just say, hey, I'm going to join with people on the left. I'm going to join the Bernie Sanders movement, who I know you actually did support at one time, I think, early in your life. We're really going to try to restructure family policy. You do have those ideas, but core to it is that you want to close off the option to abortion. And that's where I think a lot of people, you know, would get off the bus there. They don't want somebody to have to make that choice, but they do want that choice to be available to them. And more to the point, they don't believe that people who make that choice for non-coerced reasons, people who make that choice because it is just the right choice for them, not because they don't have the money or the moment, but maybe they have three kids. Maybe one of them has developmental disabilities already. Maybe they cannot, in their view, do a good job caring for another child and still lead anything like the life they've hoped for themselves. That in that scenario, which is, I think, a quite common one, you know, not necessarily the exact, but broadly, that having the choice makes people better off than they would otherwise be. And I think you're saying it doesn't, and it doesn't because having the choice has made it so they don't have any of these other policies. And that's where I have a little bit of trouble following you.
Yeah. So I think that's really a pointed question and an important one, because my view is that unlimited choice itself. So first of all, we have to remember how radical our abortion law has been in this country. It sort of strengthens. I mean, this is coming from, you know, pro-choice Georgetown law professor Robin West, I think, has been really good on this, where she has talked about how these choice-based arguments basically strengthen the kind of impulse of our very libertarian culture and politics to kind of leave women with the consequences of the bargain, basically, the consequences of her having gotten pregnant. And I think if you think about it, it's not just a coercion, say like, oh, you know, her boyfriend is telling her to have an abortion or he won't, you know, stay with her. But there's also a real deep kind of, because of, I think, of our libertarian culture, a real deep anti-natalism, an anti, the way in which we treat pregnant women in the workplace culture, massive pregnancy discrimination still, the kind of workplace conditions that especially poor women have, where they have to return to work. Many women have to return to work within like 2 weeks or less of giving birth. And so there's all sorts of structural conditions where there is still no choice. So yes, I want to, you know, I think there should be massive realignment where there's a real renewed attention to, and we can talk about, you know, how I might differ with how the left thinks about that, but support of caregiving. But just the fact that there is a choice means that employers see it as a cheaper choice. And so this is exactly why you have employers, you know, corporations, you have, you know, states talking about the corporate case for reproductive health, is that it's a far cheaper option than accommodations for pregnancy, accommodations for caregiving. And so when they're thinking about sort of the bottom line, this is the way they're going to go.
I think the argument you're making here would make an implicit prediction. If it's the existence of choice that is strengthening this libertarian culture, that is strengthening, I guess, employers who want women to get abortions so there's no interruption to their time in the workplace, I think then you'd expect to see much more pro-family policies in places that are opposed to abortion rights, not in places where they're broadly supported. But that's not what you see. So to give an example, 11 states have enacted paid family leave laws. California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Massachusetts, Maryland, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Rhode Island, and Washington. All of them, every single one of them, has a firm commitment to abortion rights. And then if you look on the other side of that, the 13 states with trigger laws that will make abortion illegal the moment Roe is overturned or very, very shortly thereafter, none of them have paid leave laws on the books. And so that makes it hard for me to believe that it's the choice here that is leading to the anti-family policy, because it seems to me that a lot of these more pro-family, less market-driven policies that you would prefer, that you would see as evidence of a more pro-family equilibrium, are actually supported and implemented by the coalition that also believes in abortion rights.
Right. And when you look at those states who, again, sitting here in Massachusetts, have much better kind of pro-woman, pro-family policies, they also have very high abortion rates. And so we don't really know what it is that's pushing women to have those abortions. It would seem that if you had all those pro-family policies, then the abortion rate would go down if we were only going to kind of trust this idea that pro-family policy equals lower abortion rates, when that's not the case either. So it seems to me that neither the red states or the blue states are doing a good job at this. So basically, like, red states can't be able to stand on their kind of, you know, if Roe is overturned, their post-Roe abortion bans, basically as this kind of evidence of their pro-life accomplishment, and then have their pregnant residents basically face poverty, substandard healthcare as compared to the blue states, and basically not, you know, far worse workplace accommodations that have been required by law. But I think in the same way that the blue states can't then stand on all their more generous, you know, health, welfare, and work supports as evidence of their kind of pro-woman bona fides, while there's this kind of, again, coercive underbelly of unlimited choice. So in these states, there is going then to be some sort of coercion toward abortion. And again, it's not necessarily, you know, by the employer looking at them and pointing their finger, but because of its availability, it becomes an open option and something that, because it's much harder to have a child than, you know, walk into an abortion clinic, it becomes an easier choice for that person, one which potentially a woman then suffers regrets from. The better answer is to have abortion restrictions and have these, you know, pro-family policies. Are the red states doing it? No. Am I hoping to try to convince them to do it? Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that that's the work of the pro-life movement going forward.
But I don't think, I mean, and I do believe this is where some of this diverges. I don't know that the goal of paid family leave policy or of childcare policy or of a lot of other things that I would think of as pro-family, or for that matter, of a child allowance policy, which you put into the book, which I very deeply agree with. I don't think most liberals who support those policies would say the actual point of them is to lower abortion rates. It is to give people the opportunity to make a less coerced choice, and that anything that reduces a coercion of that choice is the goal. So, you know, having better paid family leave, you know, I don't think it would be a huge, huge, huge driver of people's fertility decisions one way or the other. I just think it's good. And I think it's telling that it comes from the places where the general view is people should have more choices. I mean, because you keep using coercion here as the term, the description for the decision people make to have an abortion. But I think a lot of people, and I would be one of them, would understand coercion as at least as properly, if not more so, applying to a world where women no longer had the opportunity to end an unwanted pregnancy. And it's specifically because of the absence of this idea and this reality of choice. I mean, you said many people end up regretting abortion, but I don't think actually the evidence really holds that so deeply. The best study I know of on this is the Turnaway study, which was able to look at people who got turned away from having an abortion and people who didn't. And 5 years on, 99% of women, 99% who had the abortion said it was the right decision for them, and they were better off on a range of other health and economic outcomes. So I can understand the argument that abortion should be illegal because it is a taking of a life, and I simply disagree with that. But the argument being made here that it's better for women to not have this choice, I don't think that's right. And I think the people standing on the other side of it are not making the distinction you're making. They're not saying we should have more abortion so that we can, you know, have more market. It's the same people who are saying, you know, Roe should be upheld, you know, who are working assiduously to try to give people more room from the market to make decisions for their families and for their lives. Now, like maybe that's a big coalition that can be built, and I hope so. But that's where I'm trying to pick at the logic of this causal connection between having abortion rights and having anti-family policy, because I think in the places where you would think that would bite, you see, in fact, the exact opposite.
Yeah, so I think it's important, and I want to really get to kind of push you a little bit on the abortion question. But before I do so, when you look at actually the Turnaway study, one thing that wasn't as highlighted is the fact that for those women who were actually denied an abortion only 1 week after seeking an abortion, but then being denied it, 35% of those women no longer wished they could have aborted. And then 5 years after having been denied abortion, when they have, I don't know, a four-year-old or so, 96% of those women said they no longer wish they could have had one. So there is a way in which that abortion choice, especially in the way that we have it, it allows a woman to do something that may not be in her best interests down the road. Then, of course, the question of the interests of the child, which I think I want to push you on, because I'm always sort of shocked that progressives, and this is something Daniel Williams points out in his book about the history of the pro-life movement, that progressives tend to be very concerned with vulnerability, with care for the vulnerable, care for the dependent. And I guess I don't really understand sometimes why it is that suddenly there's all this talk about autonomy. And, you know, there's sort of a, I think, a very Lockean approach to the way progressives talk about abortion rights and this idea that kind of the child, well, they don't call it the child, the fetus is like a trespasser on their property of their body, you know, the self-ownership of their body, again, in a very Lockean way. And they then have this right to kind of dispel anyone who comes through it in a kind of an absolute property right. When it seems to me that progressives, I think, and in the progressive tradition, that there's this a better understanding of kind of the duties of care we owe one another, that we're all interdependent, that there's more of a responsibility for those who are vulnerable and dependent. And it seems to me that the child who is a human being and is really utterly dependent on his or her mother at that time for those 9 months is, you know, the most vulnerable and the most dependent. And so it brings, you know, more obligations for that woman to not only give care to the child, but then also to have the community around her, first and foremost, the child's father, but then all of society find ways to help her, that there are these kind of interweaving dependencies and duties of care. And I guess I don't understand why it is that we could, you know, not think that there are two, you know, human beings here, and certainly their rights to life can conflict sometimes. And that's a time when the mother's life at that point could very much be prioritized, and the death of the child could be, you know, a sad result, but a result nonetheless. But why is it that we don't think of the duties of care that are owed to this other human being who is vulnerable, who is dependent? And I guess I don't understand why progressives have suddenly they start talking and like they're John Locke, like they're these, you know, property rights gurus. And it just doesn't fly with me in terms of the way progressives think about the kind of the solidarity that we ought to have with the poor in general.
I don't know about property rights gurus, so we'll see if you think my answer here sounds too Lockean to you. I'll say a couple of things. One, I don't think these decisions are easy for most people. And in part because I don't think they're easy, and because in part I don't think people take them lightly, I don't think they are best made by the government. I don't believe in a positive duty to have abortions. I believe in people's ability to make decisions for themselves that are the right decisions. And I don't take any of this abstractly. I won't speak for all progressives, but I have two children. I have a three-year-old and a seven-month-old. And they are everything to me. I mean, they are everything. And I had the experience of watching my wife go through two of the most medically agonizing, dangerous pregnancies I have ever been anywhere near. And watching someone hurt that much every single day for 5 months, and I don't want to tell more of her story than it's mine to tell, made me much more firm in my view that this is not for other people or even chance to tell people how to make that decision. And if within my committed partnership, my marriage, where we take care of two children and two mediocrely behaved dogs and have a lot of responsibilities and try to live lives. I mean, I think as you describe in the book, where virtue and obligation are central to the way we think of every single day. If we got pregnant again, it would be dangerous. And the idea that somebody else is going to come in and say, too bad, you know, like, I think I know better than you, like what that means. So obviously, some of this resolves down to questions of personhood and, you know, how you understand the way moral weight and rights develop. And I'm somebody who thinks a fetus at 10 weeks is different than someone at 30 weeks and doesn't think there's an easy way to draw the line. But nevertheless, a lot of politics and a lot of hard policymaking is creating space where at least people can draw their own lines to some degree. But it is not because, to me, there isn't a duty to care for the vulnerable, but, you know, that people have some amount of right to self-determination, that there are a lot of ways to bring and support life in this world. There'd be a lot of ways to help people have children they deeply want to have and cannot because of medical reasons, because of financial reasons. And having the state come in and tell people that because their husband coerced them one night, you know, off of the, or just because they had a night of passion, doesn't need to be coerced, because they felt really in love that night, that now you have a fifth child who you don't know how you can care for. I don't think you have to imagine an unborn child as a trespasser to think that people should have the ability and will be better off if they have the ability to set their own life course in that moment. And so I want to make that choice as free as possible. I want to make sure people have every support they want. I would like to have, and I believe one should have, a more natalist equilibrium in this country by a lot. But I don't think, and this is where I think we disagree quite deeply, I don't think the way to get there is taking away people's choices. One of my concerns about this sometimes is that I think it, when we're talking about women here, I think it would be different if we were actually talking about unborn children, but I think it sounds very abstract. But I think the choices people actually have to make are agonizing, and they agonize over them. And we should trust often that they know better than we do.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously appreciate the difficult circumstances that you've personally had. And I think, you know, there are many women who have difficult or dangerous pregnancies. Most don't. Most pregnancies aren't dangerous and are sort of natural experiences of how of bringing, you know, human life into the world. And I guess the most fundamental difference I think that we have is that for me, when the child exists, you know, it's a new human being who is a self-directed human being who has parts of both myself and the father, you know, the mother and the father, and therefore is our child, that we owe duties to that child as much as possible as we owe duties to our other children who are already born. And so, to my mind, the medical establishment ought to be always thinking of those two patients together, the mother and the child, because not only does the mother owe those duties and the father owes those duties to the child and the father to the mother as well, but the medical establishment also owes those duties to both mother and child at that time. So to my mind, you know, I think that there's, again, a way in which we have not made as many advances in maternal care and fetal care for women in difficult pregnancies and difficult situations because we've had that kind of easy answer. I don't mean easy as in not difficult for a mother to, and potentially a father to make in terms of agonizing, emotionally agonizing, but that it's kind of there for the taking rather than having pushed further to say, there are two patients here to whom we owe these duties of care. And so we ought to find ways to ensure that as much as possible, we can make sure that the child is cared for. Now, are there times when there are life-threatening situations or times in which, you know, there could be serious bodily injury, which would require either, you know, the early delivery of a child or, you know, in cases of ectopic pregnancy, the removal of the embryo from the fallopian tubes to save the life of the mother? I mean, all these kinds of things are, it seems to me, quite humane to allow just out of basic proportionality, you know, like basically saying, yes, there are two lives here and we ought to care for both, but the mother does take some priority. But I think, again, we could restructure things so that both are taken seriously and so that we owe this duty as much as possible to this other child.
So the other question that a lot of people have when they think about Roe falling, when they look at some of these trigger laws, is what happens in the case of rape when women seek abortions? In April, Oklahoma's governor, Kevin Stitt, signed legislation that bans abortion and does not have an exemption for rape. How do you think about those cases?
I think you're seeing, you know, there's just more and more people who call themselves abortion abolitionists who would not want to see these kinds of exceptions. The child who's conceived in rape has the same equal dignity and therefore the same sort of duties of care are owed. And so in that way, I think that there's all sorts of women out there whose parents conceived them in rape and whose mothers kind of heroically gave birth to them despite this violent assault on them. And so there are those who argue in the pro-life movement that abortion is actually kind of a second violent act against the pregnant woman. My view of this is that I think because of the entire lack of consent to engage in that act that can foreseeably cause a pregnancy, that it's understandable as a prudential matter to allow abortion in that case. I mean, I think it should be limited into, you know, very early pregnancy. I think something like the morning after pill would obviously be the best possible situation. But I think that's sort of my answer, is that were she to go to a hospital and then be given something to potentially even prevent conception would be the best possible route. I think one thing that actually, you know, my tribe does poorly is has this idea that because there are equal rights, you know, because the argument is that, you know, by virtue of being human, the week old embryo has equal rights to the mother who is, you know, out walking around carrying this embryo, that there aren't differences and kind of differences in wrongs of late stage versus early stage abortions. And for my tribe, I would really commend to them the work of Christopher Kaiser on this, where he has an essay called Equal Rights and Unequal Wrongs. And so to my mind, you know, an abortion restriction that restricted late term abortions would be very much a celebration, even if it allowed some early term abortions. I think that is a place that, you know, in my own state, I hope we can work toward, that there's ways to think about abortion where having those late stage abortions are worse for. Obviously, they're the same. You're still taking the child's life, but they're worse for society. They're worse for the mother. They're sort of a worse moral act. And I hope we can take that seriously as well.
So I respect and disagree with the view. I mean, I guess obviously that there is a quality of weight and rights the whole way through. And that's a place where I think the abortion debate is really hard, because once you end up on opposite sides of that line, you're just dealing with very different and somewhat unresolvable moral and philosophical and religious intuitions. But one thing that interested me about your book is that you really, I think you believe that argument. I think, and I want to say clearly, like, I respect that argument. It's not my view, but I see how it is held, and I believe it's held very, very strongly and humanely. But you are making an argument through the book. You really try to frame this around what is best for women. You really push on, say, the idea that abortion has led to a feminization of poverty, that it has led to all of these downstream bad outcomes that have been bad for people who do want to use that choice, who do see this differently than you do. And that's where I think it's an important point. I think it's actually a very important move in this debate, because particularly in a world where Roe is about to be overturned and where we can't govern directly through sort of religious argumentation, people are going to be trying to make arguments about what is better for a lot of different classes in this discussion that can be proven, measured, discussed. And so that's why I'm kind of pushing on this question of the outcomes for women. I mean, I'll give another example of this that struck me reading the book. So you lament throughout the book, and I think correctly, this pretty profound now divergence in marriage numbers and divorce numbers and single parenthood numbers between college-educated and non-college-educated women. You've mentioned Bell Sawhill's work here, and she makes this point that marriage and having children inside of marriage has become a very important and profound class marker. But when I think about restricting abortion, potentially restricting contraception or pushing people towards forms of contraception that are, I think, at least more difficult to use. I think it's very clear that would make that divergence worse. I mean, I think the obvious outcome there would be highly educated, resourced women are going to have high quality contraception. They're going to have the ability to get abortions, and poor women, particularly in red states, don't. And so it's that argument that I'm trying to untangle, that it seems to me that you're justifying some of these arguments on, for instance, saying we'll get to a more equal world there. But what flaw do you see in my logic? How would that not make the world and the outcomes here more unequal?
Yeah, so I guess I see that if you restrict abortion, and again, I mean, if you, in general, what it helps us to do, especially if there are really important legislative debates, especially in purple states, I think we're going to see about really what we owe the unborn child. I think those are the kinds of legislative debates that we haven't been able to have because Roe foreclosed those. And I think those are kind of essential to both what we owe the child, but then what we owe the child's mother, what we owe the child's father, what all of society kind of owes the family. And I think those kinds of debates are essential for us going forward, because we've been able to kind of sit in this, I think, sexual more libertarian on the left and economically more libertarian on the right. And I think that Roe is going to require us to think about all of those kind of views that we hold. And I'm looking forward to those debates. But in terms of the poor woman, I think what it does by kind of resetting this question is that the law does teach. And by saying that, you know, there are all sorts of people, maybe not everyone in the country, obviously, who believe that there is a child's life is taken in abortion and that we actually owe duties to that child, that it helps sort of reset thinking about sex itself, that I think it ought to help us take sex more seriously. And that itself may empower women. I hope it would empower women to kind of take their place again as gatekeepers of sex. And that is to expect kind of more from men when they engage in sex, to expect commitment. Because if they do wait, I mean, if they are able to put off men and to expect more from them, to expect a greater maturity, to expect them to hold down a job, to expect them to get off their computers and get off porn and all sorts of things, that I think there could be a real maturation of men that is required. I'm not saying that it is women who mature men mature themselves, but by women taking seriously kind of these asymmetrical burdens that she holds in sexual intercourse, that it hopefully will empower her to just say no more and expect more. And then, you know, as the economists say, kind of raise the cost of sex. I think that would be a good thing. And I think that would be a very good thing in poor neighborhoods where women just don't have the kind of bargaining power that wealthy, educated women have in relationships. And so that's my hope, that we would see something like that. And I'll certainly be working toward that.
That feels strange to me, given, I think, the pattern in what we've seen in sort of family formation and outcomes in poor neighborhoods over the past, you know, however many decades. And so I think let me try to give an alternative account, and you can tell me where you see holes in it. One of the things that has struck me about a lot of the rising right-wing thinking about the family and about the crisis of single parenthood and divorce and low marriage rates in poor communities is that for a long time, this same critique was being made, but it was aimed really tightly at the Black community. You know, going all the way back to the famous Moynihan Report on the problems of the Black family. And what emerged out of it, I think, was a view, to go to your point about law as teacher, that people needed to be taught, they needed a cultural upheaval, and two things came out of that. So one, there was a tremendous amount of condemnation, responsibility politics. I mean, on both sides of the aisle, you heard this from Bill Clinton, you sometimes heard it from Jesse Jackson, you heard it at moments from Barack Obama. But for a long time, there was a real belief that what had to happen is people had to be told in the Black community, the men weren't taking responsibility. And, you know, there are these cultural pathologies. And then, as you say, the law was supposed to be teacher. We were going to, you know, incarcerate many more people through, you know, much tougher criminal policies, that we were going to push much harder through work requirements and welfare. We were going to use the law to teach people how we wanted them to act. And what I would say is true about that period is it completely and utterly failed. And then what happened is many of these issues that we saw in Black communities began to show up at a lag in white communities. And so as that happened, I think that the way particularly the right, although not only, began to approach them became much more humane, much more, well, they've been failed by policy, there are economic problems, addiction is a disease, you know, how opioids have been treated versus how crack was treated is very, very, very telling. But when I look at it, what I see is a kind of two consistent things. One is that across, you know, rich countries, you know, all over the world, you're seeing declines in marriage rates, rising, you know, single parenthood. European countries have lower marriage rates than we do. And there is a lot of evidence, I think, at this point, that pretty unchecked capitalism and a lot of inequality is a real driver of family breakdown in poor communities. And this goes to your point in the oft-made observation that college-educated people tend to be marrying and having children within marriage and staying married at much higher rates. And I think the very simple takeaway from that is that when you don't have the economic stress on the relationship is more likely to form and is also more likely to survive. So there does seem to me to be a tremendous amount of pressure and reason we should be really, really working and really lamenting and really trying to repair how much economic damage we've done. But I think one place I really diverge is I am very skeptical, and from having watched this play out in different ways, I'm very skeptical that trying to punish people more culturally or otherwise, or through the law, trying to use the law as a harsh teacher works. Because I think if it did work, we would have seen it worked when we used it very, very harshly for a very long time.
Yeah, I guess I am not seeing the law as the harsh teacher or the punisher. I'm not sure where you're getting that out of my work. I actually think, you know, massive incarceration is a massive problem because of the way in which it pulls fathers away from their children. To me, it seems like it's not just the poor who need self-discipline. It's all of us who need self-discipline. Like, this is just a basic means toward happiness. And it just so happens that in wealthier elite families, there's more habits of self-discipline because of, you know, schooling and all sorts of things like that. And it seems like it's an important human goal to have parents be the ones who inculcate self-discipline in their children, and thereby doing that, inculcate self-discipline in themselves. So I don't really see it as like the state being the one who's disciplining people at all, but I just see it as something where when we take kind of the natural facts of human reproduction seriously, that women, that there are asymmetrical burdens on women, and therefore women should hold men off more and expect more from them. That's not, I don't see anything punitive there at all. I actually just see women being empowered with really kind of the facts of life. And in the same way, I think that, you know, enabling and kind of, again, empowering the poor to take seriously the really important work of the home, of rearing children, is basically what the rich already do. And it's kind of not fair that the wealthy, the rich, you know, the well-educated see how important it is to kind of prioritize their children's development, their children's moral and intellectual development, and then say, oh, well, we shouldn't expect that of the poor. To me, that is actually more of kind of a flawed way of thinking about the capacities of the poor. And this is something I've really, I think, learned from Mary Wollstonecraft, who really saw equality, like our human equality is not in how much property we own or wealth we have or, you know, how much money we make or anything, but it's just in our equal human capacity for moral development. And I think rich and poor both have that, and that should be an expectation that we, that our laws have, is that we all ought to be sort of striving for moral development. And so we ought not kind of shield moral responsibility from the poor or the rich, that our laws and our policies should be enabling people to carry out their obligations to one another. Because I think in general, that's how people develop virtuously. And that's how that tends to lead toward both personal and societal happiness.
I mean, I do think this gets to a very key thing in your thought, which is that the structure of our laws, the structure of our culture should be more oriented towards pushing people towards a certain definition, but of a virtuous and an excellent life. Virtue is very hard to conduct. And I think one place where I think you and I have parted a bit is I want to limit often the consequences for people who have had moments where their commitment to self-discipline or self-mastery failed. You know, you were saying earlier that a lot of pregnancies, most pregnancies, in fact, are not dangerous. And I take that point. But parenting is very profound. It alters and transforms your life deeply. And I don't think most parents, certainly not myself, would, you know, then go and say, well, I regret having children. But it's something that I think really, really, really radically changes everything. And it can be dangerous for people. I mean, it's much safer now, but a lot of women die in childbirth, particularly a lot of Black women die in childbirth. And so to me, there's something here about, I could kind of imagine why one would want a social movement that is pushing restraint, right? That is pushing this idea, as you have it, that women should be sexual gatekeepers and expect more discipline and self-mastery from men. But in a world where I think a lot of women don't want to do that, a lot of men are not going to follow that, I think there's good reason, if we're looking at it from the perspective of their interests, which is, I think, one of the premises of the book, that we wouldn't want to say, well, in a moment where that failed, or the particular contraception you used failed, you know, well, now everything is different. Because I think there isn't a deep interest people have in being able to live their life in the way they hope to live it, and making those choices as free as possible, as opposed to really constricting one path, even as we open maybe with more progressive family policy another, you know, I think will lead to a lot of hardship for folks. You know, maybe some of them who deserve it under a question of virtue, but many who don't, or, you know, and all of whom were just, you know, human, have their failures, just like I constantly do.
Yeah. So really the book is a push towards seeing how all of that work really underlies kind of our economics, our politics, our civic life, and that's why we should be focusing on caregiving, because it's really the most important work that is done. I guess I would say in response is that I think it's really important that we have high expectations, in part because there is a way, I mean, there's this kind of new antinatalism, this new, you know, people sort of deciding, you know, ex ante that they never want to become parents. And I think that the cultural push toward that is that we don't see, you know, we don't have experiences with as much because of, you know, decline in fertility and all that, with aunts and uncles, with siblings. And so people don't realize what they're missing out on when they make those sorts of determinations well ahead of time. And as you say, parenting is profound. And I think for eons and eons, what human beings have seen is that becoming a mother or father really develops the person, requires a great movement away from the focus on self toward another, you know, toward what Mary Wollstonecraft saw would be real a benevolence, and in order to then be able to focus on others outside of your family as well. And that maturation process, I think, is most definitely needed in our culture right now on the part of both men and women. I have certainly been matured by becoming a mother. I've seen that with family members. I've seen that with friends. And it's something that they don't realize the kind of transformation that they could have put off, but now are so grateful that they had. And I think it's okay, and I think it's actually good for a culture to kind of have these high expectations that we want mature citizens and that we see kind of the call toward parenting that every, you know, generations and generations of basically world history has seen as an important marker of maturity. I just think that that's a good thing. I would want to see more of it. And I think the kind of quest for autonomy tends to leave people really empty, tends to leave people, I mean, literally alone. We have a loneliness epidemic. And I think more children is a good thing. And so helping people who are unexpected in pregnancy, who don't think that they can handle it, helping them find the resources, whether it's financial, whether it's social, whether it's emotional, civic resources, government resources, et cetera, to kind of be transformed by caring for other people is just a good thing.
Summer, the best time of year, usually doesn't come with a great deal. Soaring temperatures come with soaring prices. But what if there's another way? With IKEA, your summer plans can last longer than 2 weeks of vacation and be more affordable. Here, everyone can have lounge chair access, no reservations needed. From affordable outdoor furniture to stylish accessories, we have all the essentials you need to soak up summer in style, no matter the size of your space. Start planning a better summer with IKEA. It's your outdoor dreams inside your budget.
Let's talk a bit about holding questions of reproductive law to the side. What you think would make America, what cultural changes and policy changes you think would make America a much friendlier and encouraging environment for people to have families, and how to value that work. Because something you say throughout the book that I think is very, very pointed and very true is that the family is not parasitic on the market. The market is parasitic on the family. And we often get that backwards. So what would it mean to value the care work done inside of families at the level that it should be valued? How do you imagine that looking as a society?
So there's a lot of real heroes in the book. One of the great lines of Jane Addams, who formed Hull House during the time of the Industrial Revolution, when, you know, there were literally like women who were sent into horrible working places, working conditions, and had to sort of, you know, leave their children bereft of any care. She had this nice phrase, which I really like, where she talks about how we have to have, well, she didn't say policies, but I'm going to put it in this way, policies that prioritize what she said was the family claim over the social claim. And, you know, there was a move toward this, and it was right when I was kind of cutting my teeth. Then that you mentioned I was a Bernie supporter, but I was studying sociology, women's studies, and then moved toward political theory in college. And it was right in the 1990s when the communitarians were sort of pushing back on some of the libertarian family policy, economic, or lack of family policy altogether, but economic policy. And there were people from both the left and the right who, you know, I started to read a lot, Michael Sandel, Emma Tazzone, and especially for me, Marianne Glendon. And that communitarian movement, from what I understand, was torn apart because of differences of abortion. And so my hope is in kind of in a post-Roe era that kind of like a communitarian movement could grow back again. And so, you know, one of the, in their communitarian platform, I can't remember if this is in the family policy part of it or just the platform itself, but they have this nice line that a responsive community must act to smooth the path for parents so that the joys of family life might be more easily felt and its burdens more fairly borne. And so I think it's really implicit in the whole of the book that the caring for children and the work of the home is something that all of society benefits from, and yet parents are the ones who take on those sacrifices. And so the idea of kind of spreading costs of child rearing more fully across society is, I think, just a just kind of thing. And so thinking of the market as something that serves families and not just that families serve the market, I think is a kind of a good way to think about it. So what are some policies that do that? Now, I am not a policy wonk. I would greatly recommend the work of my colleague at Ethics and Public Policy Center, Patrick Brown. You know, I lay out some, at the very end of my book, some policies that I think would be useful. And they're more sort of principles than actual policies out there. But I think workplace flexibility is a really, really important one, and predictable scheduling. I think that upper echelons of workers have this kind of knit into their work, and that those who are low-wage workers really, you know, it's the just-in-time scheduling where they're given their schedules barely a week ahead of time and have all sorts of difficult childcare predicaments because of that, that there should really just be a lot more workplace flexibility just as a humane kind of standard. I think that both left and right, and you're already seeing this in the states, could get behind the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, which is a move past the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which is an advance from that, requiring reasonable accommodations for pregnant employees. I think, you know, there's just a real important principle. And I think this is where, you know, that parents really should not be economically disadvantaged by raising children. I think it's really important too that we not penalize those mothers and fathers who want to have one of them stay home, and pushing for part-time pay equity. So women who, you know, are mothers, sometimes this is, you know, men who are home, but usually mothers, you know, don't have to kind of pay this mommy tax where they make disproportionately less just because their mothers. I think this is a place where policy is really, really important, that we ought not assume that, you know, things like parental leave, which I very much support, should be trying to get women back to the workplace as fast as possible. You know, it should be really a time off, and that we should support other things that you support as well as other types of things like a family allowance. Again, the right is certainly in big discussions about kind of the unintended consequences of decoupling work from that. I would send you to people like Orrin Cass at American Compass and Patrick Brown in terms of, you know, really kind of getting at the nuts and bolts of like Romney's policy and how that would work. But I think making sure that the work of the home is taken so seriously, is seen as so important, that any choice that parents make to stay home should not disproportionately affect them, so that policy is only supporting those people who want to put their children in daycare. Obviously, some people do have to put their children in daycare, and the very poor, especially if they're not able to have one person stay home, then we ought to be helping them with daycare as well. But I think some of those things that, you know, we put, as I say in the book, a man on the moon, you know, with kind of government priorities, why aren't we prioritizing the really important work that takes place in the home? And so those are, you know, some of the basic things that I would say.
In some ways, on the child allowance piece particularly, I was surprised you didn't go even more radical on that, because I think there is a growing movement for a child allowance. We passed one in the American Rescue Plan, which is now expiring, unfortunately, because Democrats can't get the votes to extend it. Romney has one, but he doesn't really have many or virtually any Republican co-sponsors. But even if you make one of those permanent, I mean, that would be good, but it's a couple thousand bucks a kid, really. And that's a far cry from, you know, what you make in the workforce. And it's never struck me as genuinely impossible to imagine a world where people get paid at, say, the local median wage for staying home with a child, or get replaced at 80% of their previous wage or something like that. A lot of different ways one would have to think about both financing and structuring it. But if this work is so important, you could functionally become a government employee if you could prove that you become a full-time parent. And as somebody who spent a lot of time parenting, I think it's a lot harder than my job. My job is full of, you know, autonomy and finishable tasks, and people tell me I did a good job, and parenting is much, much tougher. And I'm always struck that I see so few people actually arguing that there should be a true parenting wage. And I think, you know, if you passed all those policies, as somebody who believes in all of them, and you know, they're closer to being true in some places than others, I'm not sure how far they actually get you. To the point of some of the things you say in the book, I think that to get to the kind of genuinely like natalist structure that you want, and that in some ways I want, although with differences around reproductive choice, you have to really, really, really rethink things profoundly. You can't have this just gigantic, endless gap between working and parenting. If parenting is so valuable, then, you know, particularly a very rich country needs to figure out how to value it. And even the very progressive policies I see right now around child benefits, they don't.
Yeah, you know, and I think that this is a place where I hope, you know, left and right come together, sit down, and kind of work out their differences. Theoretically, I think you're right that it does make sense from my perspective to have as much possible remuneration, you would say, for the work of the home. At the same time, though, I don't want it to be something that becomes akin to kind of a part or a piece or part of the market. So there's a way in which it ought to be valued apart from the work, kind of wage labor in that sense, right? So it's a tricky thing. But I think, you know, one of the other things that I mentioned is, you know, making sure that women who have had children, and again, this could be again for a man who's home instead, but have stepped out for the labor market, don't suffer kind of the loss of wages. And how do you do that? Well, by making sure that they have no income taxes going forward, that potentially, you know, that they earn Social Security benefits. I think that may be a way of doing the same sort of thing in a structure that's already there. And I know someone who's an expert on ERISA, on, you know, retirement benefits, who's working quite hard at figuring out how this would work. So I think there's all sorts of ways that you do it. And again, because I don't have expertise in that area, I'm not all that comfortable weighing in on the exact policies, on the exact numbers. And there's also kind of the unintended consequences that, you know, you don't want to crowd out the work that fathers need to do because of the asymmetrical burdens that women have in childbearing, that men do need to be involved. And part of that involvement is financial provision. And so if the government steps in and at such a high rate that, you know, men don't need to be making sure that they're providing for their children financially, and hopefully while they, you know, when they take seriously that financial obligation, that they start to take seriously that being attentive and the emotional obligation as well. I think that's really important, and I wouldn't want to crowd that out. So that's where there's a bit of a complication, and I'd want really experts. I'd like to be in the room, but I'd also want real policy experts kind of hashing these things out, and I hope we get to the place where we can do that.
So then, always our final question. What are three books that have influenced you that you would recommend to the audience?
So the three books I picked, I mean, I'm sure all of your guests say it's so difficult to do so, but I decided I would really pick three books that were incredibly formative for me. You know, after my time as a women's studies student at Middlebury College, when I was kind of changing my views about things in a lot of different ways, but I fell upon, again, the communitarian movement and started reading a lot of Marianne Glendon's work. In the book, I argue that she's really the complete kind of and true heir of, you know, what I lay out as this Wollstonecraftian vision. And so have an entire chapter devoted to her really what I call dignitarian thought too. I sort of think of her as both a communitarian and a dignitarian, but her book Rights Talk was incredibly influential. For those who don't know her, Marianne Glendon is just a newly retired, so now emeritus professor of Harvard Law School. And in that book, she gives a kind of, I think, very even-handed critique of the libertarian philosophy that's really at the heart of much sort of thinking on both the left and the right, and how there's kind of a neglect of a real robust American tradition of concern for the vulnerable, the dependent, kind of a tradition of hospitality and the common good. The second book is by historian Elizabeth Fox Genovese, which is a book called Feminism Without Illusions. She is the late founder of the Women's Studies program at Emory University. In this book, Feminism Without Illusions is a critique of liberal individualism and, again, libertarianism in modern feminism. And the third book is a book by the late University of Chicago political theorist Jean Beth Ullstein, her book, Public Man, Private Woman. And in a similar way, although she is diving really deeply into how Western political theorists, you know, starting with Plato and Aristotle and up through, have really thought about man and woman and public life and private life and kind of the relation between them. And it's really a call at the end there for a revaluation of, you know, the work that's done in the private sphere, as we call it now, and their real attention to the needs of children, especially within feminism. And she concludes really an incredibly learned book with this in her last chapter, and I'll quote, "I'm calling here for redemption of everyday life, a recognition of the joys and vexations, its values and purpose, and its place in becoming human." And I think this is really, in some ways, in some really fundamental way, the call of my book as well.
Erica Bakayaki, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Ezra.
The Ezra Klein Show is produced by Annie Galvin, Jeff Geld, and Roger Karma. Fact-checking by Mary Marge Locker and Kate Sinclair. Original music by Isaac Jones. Mixing by Jeff Geld. Audience strategy by Shannon Busta. Our executive producer is Irene Noguchi, and special thanks to Kristen Lin and Christina Samulewski.
Chapter 1. Wayfair welcomes you to the neighborhood. Our hero, Titus Burgess, ambled down the stylish street of an enchanting utopia. A woman waved from a chic lounger. "Welcome to the neighborhood," she said, "where Wayfair helps everyone create a home they love." Titus stared in awe. Bohemian Boulevard, Trendsetter Terrace, Mid-Century Circle.
Titus, You're reading the Wayfair catalog.
Oh, you'll love Chapter 2. Wayfair's fast and free shipping saves the potluck.
Wayfair, every style, every home.